Cue that fancy intro music. It's time to unleash your star power and own your dreams without selling your soul. It's time for some creative freedom. I'm Lisa Robin Young, and I'm a creative entrepreneur just like you. I'm also a business coach, helping people across the creative spectrum make great money doing what they love. If you're done with being the world's best kept secret and ready to shine like the star you are, creative freedom is for you. Let's get started. When I was 16, I was over the moon excited about getting my driver's license. I was looking forward to driver's ed. I wanted it so bad. When I was 9, I'd helped my brother study for his exam, and I held on to his copy of the driver training booklet, What Every Driver Must Know. And I read that thing so many times, I was pretty sure I had it memorized. I knew all the moves to parallel park, all the road signs at a glance, and how to safely pass a commercial vehicle. I know what to do in snow and ice, something my southern friends could probably use a refresher on that one snowfall every winter. I knew which vehicle had the right-of-way at a four-way stop and what to do when the traffic lights were out and all the other stuff that that little encyclopedia of driving wisdom had to share. But I wasn't prepared when my dad invited me out to drive. What? Me? On the road? But Dad, I don't have my license yet. I don't have my learner's permit yet. That would be breaking the law. I don't think I could do that. I don't think I'm ready for that.
Okay, kid.
And he never asked me again. When I got my permit, he still didn't ask. The next year, he asked my sister, and she jumped at the chance to hop in the car with Dad and tool around town and go get ice cream and other fun stuff that I was left out on. I was hurt. I was angry. And I didn't understand why Dad had passed me over like that in favor of my sister. Couldn't he see that I was ready now? Couldn't he see that I had more experience, more skill at driving than she did? Why was she getting the invite, but I wasn't? Sound familiar? That was one of my earliest experiences with the passed over paradox. Only I didn't know it yet. So let me break this down so that you can see what was really going on here. Now, the real reason I said no wasn't because I would have been breaking the law. No, it was because I was scared of how my dad would react with me in the driver's seat. At school, I could hop in the car, cruise around the range at 3 miles an hour, and if the teacher didn't like what I did, then okay, fine, I'll go home, I'll shake it off, I'll get my head right, and I'll come back the next day. But with Dad, there was no escape from his judgment. If he didn't like what I did, he'd broadcast it to the family, crack jokes about me, basically humiliate me in that quiet southern drawl of his. He'd already done it when I cut my hair short.
You look like a dude, kid.
God, my siblings tormented me with that for years. He'd done it any time that I did something he didn't agree with. And the emotional sting left marks that left me feeling less than confident in myself. Even though he didn't live at our house anymore, Dad had influence, and his impact and his words continued to resonate throughout that building, whether he lived there or not. At 16 or 17, I was just the right age to both want and resist my father's approval. And if it were just me, like it had been with my haircut, then I could speak my mind and I could deal with his comments. You know, you may think I look like a dude, Dad, but I like how easy it is to wear and brush my hair like this, and it doesn't get all tangled all the time, because I like short hair. But in a car, lives would be on the line. I had 2 tons of Detroit steel in my hands, flying down the real roads at 30 or 50 miles an hour. And I didn't think I could handle that kind of pressure, or what it might do to me when I got home if I'd run somebody over. Now, never mind that I really did know everything to do. Never mind that I had been practicing on the range, or that my dad probably wouldn't take me out if he didn't think I could handle it. I simply did not trust that I, me, myself, all me, body, mind, and spirit, would be safe if I went driving with my dad. He may have kept me from killing myself or somebody else, but I just knew that one wrong turn would result in years of emotional torture. So my sister got to go out driving with my dad, and they stopped for ice cream and went to the park, and they did other fun things that I missed out on because he never asked me to drive with him ever again. But here's the thing. I also never asked him to go driving with me. In fact, years later, when I had my license, I asked him why he never asked me to go driving with him again. And he said, "Well, kid, I figured you'd let me know when you were ready." Ouch. In our last episode, I introduced you to the Passover paradox, that sneaky little issue that can feel like imposter syndrome, but isn't. It has a lot of similarities, but the most pernicious is the way that it halts your momentum. It's a deer in the headlights effect that can paralyze you into inaction that lasts indefinitely. When you're stuck in the Passover paradox, you want to do things, but often fear the backlash or the crickets. Read that as judgment that might come from doing it. Therefore, you don't do it. Like when you know you should do something, but you keep procrastinating on it, even though you're fairly confident that something good will likely come out of it if you just stop procrastinating. Or when you feel overwhelmed at the laundry list of things you could be doing, all of which could move the needle, but instead of picking one and just doing it, you stay stuck and you don't make a decision to act. Or when your dad, who genuinely wants to help you succeed at the thing you most want in life, offers to help you, and you decline because of a sense that you will somehow cause harm or be harmed by saying yes. And in my case, because of some other self-worth issues I had going on in relation to my dad, I assumed he'd ask me again, and when he didn't, I made it mean something about me, and it kept me from ever asking him myself. This is the Passover paradox, hard at work, keeping you down. It causes you to question yourself, to doubt your choices. It halts courageous action. And remember, courageous action doesn't have to be massive action. It could be making a small ask or taking a big leap. Whatever courageous action looks like for you. In the Star Power Framework, the three primary courageous actions are facing your fears, correcting your course, and refining your model. We'll spend more time this season exploring each area, but today we're looking at this villain, if you will, and how it acts as an invisible ceiling on your success, on your income. That's why we're calling this episode The Invisible Cap on Your Income. Now, speaking of asks, this is your friendly reminder to pop over to our website and log into the Rising Tide Learning Library to pick up a copy of this week's downloadable. Navigate to Season 7, Episode 4, and you'll find a short guide to help you navigate the gaps between where you are and where you want to be, along with additional bonuses that I will refer to at the end of this episode to help you take the learning even deeper. Not already a member? The only investment to join the Rising Tide is your name and your email address. Now, it's an investment that I believe brings a very substantial return. We've got free training, plus downloadable bonus content from the show, all of which is designed to help you make great money doing what you love without having to sell your soul to do it. So, fear of judgment, particularly from the influencers and stakeholders that we value, coupled with the fear of being a target of harm or causing harm, which leads to that judgment thing again, that is the root of the Passover paradox. It's what stalls our progress. All you neurodivergent folks and you fusions and chaotics, hear me on this. This is one big reason why shiny objects are so attractive. If we keep chasing something new and shiny, we don't get bored. And we don't have to deal with the outcomes because there never is an outcome. There's no outcome because nothing gets finished, or at least finished enough for your world to judge it or to judge you. It's that fear of judgment that often stalls our progress and stifles our creativity. And not judgment from just anyone. Judgment from influencers that matter. Now, that could be our clients, our audience, our family, our friends, or anyone that we care about, what they think or how they view us. In an article from Harvard Business Review, which I'll link to in the show notes, authors Tom and David Kelly write the following, quote, "If the scribbling, singing, dancing kindergartner symbolizes unfettered creative expression, the awkward teenager represents the opposite, someone who cares deeply about what other people think. It takes only a few years to develop that fear of judgment, but it stays with us throughout our adult lives, often constraining our careers. Most of us accept that when we are learning, say, to ski, others will see us fall down until practice pays off. But we can't risk our business world ego in the same way. As a result, we self-edit, killing potentially creative ideas because we're afraid our bosses or peers will see us fail. We stick to safe solutions or suggestions. We hang back, allowing others to take risks. But you can't be creative if you're constantly censoring yourself." End quote. I'd go so far as to add that as creatives, it's a little painful for us to fail publicly. We're sharing little bits of ourselves through our creative work. And when we share it with the world and that world rejects it in some way, we can often take it a little personally and see it as a rejection of ourselves. We make it mean something about us when it's often not personal, kind of like I did with my dad. We just ascribe a judgment, either our own or someone else's, to us or our work. We put a lot of pressure on ourselves to be perfect right out of the gate because, oh, our fans are counting on us, or we need this to work, or we're out of business. Damn, that's a lot of pressure. And it's not at all how the creative muse works. Creativity can't be rushed or forced. Sometimes, a lot of times, it happens by accident. Remember last season's episode on the 5 signs you need to pivot? I shared all kinds of examples of companies that started off doing one thing and ended up doing something else successfully. Your goal isn't always the goal, remember? You've got to be willing to risk, to take risks. Not just any old risk, calculated risks. I'm not asking you to jump in front of a moving train here. When I was in direct sales, there was a saying, a very problematic saying, but a saying nonetheless. An idiot on fire is worth more than brains on ice. Yeah, problematic, I know. But the thrust of this statement was that your enthusiasm and passion for your offers, even if you didn't have all the product knowledge, was far more valuable and more likely to get the sale than having all the knowledge in the world and staying calm, cool, and reserved in your presentations. But there's also another invitation here. Take a risk. Put yourself out there, even if you don't have all the answers. The folks who take risks get seen, for better or worse, and they're the ones people remember. Let me be clear for the people in the back. You don't have to be a creative entrepreneur. All entrepreneurs are creative, but not all creatives are entrepreneurs. You don't have to monetize or attempt to make a living from what you're creating, in which case, you don't need to listen to the rest of this episode. But if you're choosing this path of creative entrepreneurship, you need to learn to separate yourself from your work. As a creative, you have to be willing to take those calculated risks, push those boundaries, and visit those edges. As a business owner, as an entrepreneur, you have to detach yourself from the outcome. If you can't do that, you will always be on a roller coaster every time you share something new, or you'll stop going out to the edges and just keep doing what works in some formulaic fashion. Now, formulas work, but they create mostly forgettable results. There's nothing innovative about making the same chocolate chip cookie your grandma made. It's a good cookie, why reinvent the wheel? When you need a standardized result, you want a formula that works. But when you want to be memorable, you've got to transcend the formula. Now, to that point, I am posting a link in the show notes to a YouTube video where a guy named Sir Mash-a-Lot mashes up 6 country songs to show you exactly what I mean by formulaic. It is 6 songs, all by different artists, and I'm going to break it down here so that you can see what's going on. First, there's Blake Shelton's Sure Be Cool If You Did, which was co-written in part by Rodney Clausen and Chris Tompkins, who also co-wrote Drunk on You by Luke Bryan, which is the 2nd song in this mashup. Then Chillin' It by Cole Swindell, co-written by Shane Miner, who also co-wrote Close Your Eyes by Parmalee. This Is How We Roll by Florida Georgia Line featuring Luke Bryan, which was also co-written by Cole Swindell. And then Ready, Set, Roll by Chase Rice, which is the only song not written by the Nashville singers and songwriters connected to any of the other tunes. And I'll also include links to each individual video so that you can see and hear all the originals as well. So you kind of need a map to see how these songs are all interconnected by their songwriters. But by the end of the mashup video, he has all 6 songs playing at the same time. And if you didn't know any better, you'd think it was just one country song that's just a little busy in the chorus section. And I'm going to play it for you right now. So have a listen. Incredible, right? That's the power of a formula that works. Now, most of these songs are performed by artists on the Warner label. The songwriters travel in similar circles in Nashville, and as you may have noticed, some of these are actually co-written by the same people, right? They've written more than one of these songs together. And that's what the machine cranks out. Hey, it worked for Luke Bryan, so let's do it again for Blake Shelton, and so on and so on. Now, every single one of these songs made it to the top 10 on Billboard's country charts. With results like that, why mess with a good thing, right? Well, okay, while those songs may have hit the top 10, they're mostly forgettable. Sir Mashalot proved that point by creating a song called Even Better, which I'll also link to, using the same formula that these songwriters used. And his version is probably just as good, if not better, than any of those so-called top country hits. But it barely has any views compared to the 10 to 200 million views that the original music videos have. So obviously, it's not just the formula, it's the audience and the marketing. But again, mostly forgettable. Compare that, then, to Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody. It's risky. It's taken from the album A Night at the Opera. The entire album pushed the musical limits of the day. And Brian May was quoted as saying, quote, "We had made hit records, but we hadn't had any of the money back. And if A Night at the Opera hadn't been a huge success, I think we would have just disappeared under the ocean someplace. So we were making this album knowing it was live or die," end quote. How easy it could have been to play it safe and just make more music like Killer Queen from their previous album. But they decided to go all in and crank out what ended up being the most expensive album produced at the time of its creation. They used instruments they never had before. They were using 8 generations of 24-track tape, something like 200 tracks, in a day when you could only record 24 at a time. Now, today you could easily do that with digital audio, but back then, this was miles beyond what everyone else was doing. Bohemian Rhapsody was actually 3 songs that Freddie Mercury had been working on and ended up putting them all together in what he called a mock opera suite, a style taken from the classical music world and transformed by the progressive rock ensemble. That's taking someone's formula and making it your bitch. It could have been the worst thing in the history of popular music. It was a tremendous risk. And it paid off with one of the most memorable songs in rock and roll history. I mentioned that the Passover paradox halts courageous action. Courageous action is a must for success, and I don't say that lightly. I don't throw the word must around much. So when I say it, you know it's pretty much an imperative. I have to got it, if you will. And I've said this before, and it's a drum I'm going to keep beating. Clarity begets confidence, which begets courage. The nature of success is that you get clarity on a thing, make a decision about said thing, and then take an action to change something or do something differently to get a new result, hopefully a better result. So look around you. I've had you do this exercise before. Welcome to success. Everything you see around you is your success for today. If you don't like the success you see today, you need to do something different tomorrow, or things will stay the same as they are today or get worse. That clarity shows you what needs to change, which gives you the confidence to make the decision to act. Then you take courageous action. That's how it works. Clarity, confidence to make the decision, then you take the action. Passover paradox strips you of that confidence, that clarity, which paralyzes you into inaction. It has you saying, "I'm not ready," when you've already done all the learning, all the book reading, and all the research. It's time to pull the trigger and you choke. Or it has you playing it safe, that self-editing mentioned in that Harvard Business Review article. Opting for the less objectionable, more palatable solution when the riskier, edgier option is more true to who you really are and what really matters to you. Why do we do this? Why do we let passed over paradox win? Much like imposter syndrome, fear is driving the bus. Samuel Beckett said, "Try again, fail better," which many entrepreneurs have plastered all over their vision boards because they've taken it out of context. He meant it in a totally fatalistic way, like, why bother? We're just going to fail again and again and again. And there's a great article from Melissa Turkington that explores what Beckett really meant, and I'll link to it in the show notes. But how we use it is not how he intended it. I mean, it sounds inspiring on paper, but like so many things, if we don't feel like it's safe for us to fail, we won't do the things that could cause us to fail. We won't take those risks. If you can't take those courageous actions, however small those steps might seem, you won't make progress. Fear of judgment keeps you from taking action, which then stunts your growth, stunts your income. In order to take back the keys to the bus, we've got to do a couple of things. One, we need to take the pressure off our risk-taking. And two, we need to drop the judgment around the results of the risks that we take. If you're in control of where the bus is going, fear doesn't win. Now, fear still has a voice. And remember from our last episode, there's a time and a place where legitimate fear is important because it keeps us from driving the bus off a cliff, or in more realistic terms, it keeps you from making yourself an easy target for real harm. But fear doesn't get the keys to the bus. Fear is just a passenger. So we take the pressure off by creating a space of safety for our creative work, to be able to experiment and drop the judgment. Sister Carita Kent wrote The 10 Rules for Students and Teachers that became the guiding creative principles of the art department at Immaculate Heart College, which I think was her alma mater. They're all pretty good, but here are two that I'll reference now. Rule number 4 says, consider everything an experiment. And rule number 10, which is actually a quote from composer John Cage, one of my favorite composers, we're breaking all the rules, even our own rules. And how do we do that? By leaving plenty of room for X quantities. So we're literally changing the definitions we're using for the work that we're doing. If everything is an experiment, then we approach our creative work with less judgment and more curiosity. What's going to happen if we try this? We're less concerned about the outcome when it's an experiment because, you know, we're just trying it to see what's what. It doesn't need to replace the annual income from our day job or break new ground with our clients because we're just trying this thing out to see what happens. If it turns out that everybody loves it, then great. But if not, then hey, it was just an experiment and we can go back to the drawing board and try something else next time. You get to be playful and not worry about how it's going to turn out. Oftentimes when I'm working with a client that's hit a wall in their work, I ask them what they were doing when they were their most successful. The bulk of the time, they're not talking about the specific offer that they had, but more about how they were showing up, what they were excited about. And many times the threads of that success can be used to bring success back into the company now. Why aren't you doing those things or showing up that way anymore? What happened that pulled you away from that? It's a place to look without necessarily reinventing the wheel. As an example, one of my clients got their start doing teleclasses back in the day. Now, obviously, technology has moved away from getting people on the phone. But one of the gifts of that format was that it was live and interactive. My client had moved to automated webinars and pre-recorded presentations, which still generated income, but not the same kind of results that she'd had during her teleclass days. The more we talked, the more it became clear that while those techniques can work and may still be useful in parts of her business model, it removed her too far from her people. She lit up like a Christmas tree when she got to be interactive and experiential with her audience. It was hardwired into her chaotic creative DNA. And she was exceptional at creating an experience that impacted her clients deeply. So it made sense to create something that would give her the ability to play in that way again and give potential clients a way to get a taste of her zone of genius before they actually invested in working with her. So she launched a 90-day experiment. She told everybody up front she wanted to try it out for a few months and see where it took her. No long-term commitments, no strings. If it didn't work out, she was going to close the experiment down after 90 days. And that gave her the freedom to just try it and see what would happen. The result? Her experiment bore fruit, but not in the ways we expected. She did end up closing down that group. But it opened the door to a new offer, a 5-day challenge that helped her draw in a new audience and launch a new community group that was even more of what she wanted than the original experiment. And it was aligned with her business model and her offers, as well as how she most wanted to be showing up in the world. She wasn't sure there was enough value in facilitating an online group experience in this way. But I reassured her that the value of being in a safe space and being seen and accepted for who you truly are in that space is an incredible value all by itself. And then to add her zone of genius on top of that made the whole thing incredibly valuable to her right audience. But let me reiterate something. Courageous action and massive action are not always the same. Sometimes taking massive action can be a courageous thing. Other times, it can be a great way to keep you busy doing stuff that doesn't matter. Where massive action might be overwhelming and paralyzing, courageous action gets you to move, even if it's just a teeny weeny itty bitty step. The size of the step, much like the size of your dreams, is relative and irrelevant. Remember that one small step for man was a giant leap for mankind, according to Neil Armstrong. It was the exact same step, but it had different ramifications depending on how you looked at it. And that one small step was an incredibly courageous action. And there were plenty of tiny little courageous actions that led up to the first spacewalk. I mentioned to a mastermind partner that procrastination is generally caused by a lack of clarity around some aspect of the task, or all the aspects if it feels overwhelming. Procrastination can also be a sign of readiness or lack thereof. Passed over paradox complicates things by taking away clarity, causing you to doubt the choices you're making. So sometimes a thing that already feels like a small step needs to be taken to an even smaller element. And mind mapping can be helpful with that. For example, when I used to try to clean my house in a weekend, I would get overwhelmed. Not only do I not enjoy the task, the idea of where to start almost always stopped me before I began. Even picking a room felt daunting. So I started mind mapping. The center of the map is the end goal, a clean house. Then I'd create branches for each room of the house. Those became the hub for the next level of detail. So in my office, for instance, there was my closet, my desk, each individual bookshelf, the floor, the windows, and so on. If a bookshelf or a filing cabinet felt like it was too much, then I'd break it down to one drawer or one shelf or even part of a shelf. Whatever it took to begin to feel like the goal was manageable. And I talk about dumb goals a lot. Doable, understandable, meaningful, and believable. What is the smallest unit of progress you can make that still feels meaningful to you? Filing one piece of paper usually wasn't big enough for me to feel like it was a win, but handling half a bookshelf was. Look, you can resist and stay in not enoughness all you want, but that doesn't help you get the job done. Instead, do what you can as you are able, something else I encourage my clients to do. Especially those folks with neurodivergence, disabilities, or chronic illnesses, you're dealing with a non-normative container, so you can't expect yourself to live your life or do your work in a normative way. Take massive action when it makes sense and moves the needle, but focus on taking courageous action, regardless of the size or quantity. Sometimes the courageous thing to do is to take no action at all, but to wait, be patient, and see what happens with what you've already done. As a business owner, one of your most important roles is making that decision for your organization, when to act and when to wait. Facing your fears, correcting your course, and refining your model are all elements of taking courageous action in one way or another. If you're not doing those things, then it's probably busy work. One more word about courage. What matters is the taking of the step. If it feels courageous to you, it is courageous for you. It may be especially courageous to others if it feels like something you just had to do or felt like the right thing to do, where courage doesn't even seem to play into it. When I left everything and moved to Nashville, it was not to become a country star. I took a lot of shit for it, but I was also called brave and courageous for choosing to leave everything and start over. But I really didn't feel like I had a choice. I needed an environment of empowerment to support me, and it wasn't happening in Michigan. The same for our move to Mississippi. We didn't actually want to leave our family and friends in Nashville, but it was the step we needed to take for my husband's work. And now that we packed up and moved again to Indiana, more on that in a future episode, it's the same thing. We're doing what feels like the right thing to do. We don't exactly wake up in the morning and say, gosh, we are so courageous, look at us being all brave and stuff. No. It's more like, hey, this was a step we needed to take, and we didn't see a different choice at the time. This was the best choice we could make with the information given. Now, I'm confident that being in Indiana will create some different opportunities for us, and I'm fairly sure we wouldn't be here if it wasn't the best thing for us right now. I'm also clear in this moment that we probably won't stay here forever. It may look brave to somebody else, but to me, it's just the thing we had to do. And I mean, I got some great stuff out of being in Mississippi. I've gotten some great stuff out of being in Nashville. I'm sure I'm going to get some great stuff out of being in Indiana as well. There's an aspect of refining your model, whether that's your business model, your relationship model, or your family model, and I call it bet on future you. That's what we're doing here. We're betting that our future selves will make the most of the opportunities that this move presents us. I'm betting on future me to take advantage of what's around me to be successful. And current me is taking steps every day to meet that future version of myself. That's a calculated risk that I'm willing to take. I'm willing to bet on future me. Are you willing to bet on future you? There's one final thought I want to explore here. The difference between judgment and critical thinking. You can paralyze yourself worrying about how what you're doing will be judged, but that's not the same thing as thinking critically about the actions you're taking. Mark McGuinness over at Lateral Action wrote a useful post about why critical thinking is not a creativity killer. And I mention it here because it would be easy to conflate judgment with criticism or critical analysis, critical thinking. Mark writes that, quote, "The function of critical thinking is to make something better. Used wisely, your critical faculty is one of the most powerful creative tools at your disposal," end quote. His point here is that critical thinking isn't about judging the work or the ideas. It's about the constraints or the tools that you'll use to evaluate your results once you've created something. You then create to those constraints. In my research for this episode, I might come across some great visuals, but they would be mostly meaningless for a podcast where there's no visual element. So those graphics, while useful, are not useful in this context. The constraints are those of an audio media versus a visual one, where graphics would be super useful. Now, I'm not judging the graphics as crap or worthless. I'm using critical thinking to say those don't apply here. Now, they may actually be garish or awful, but that's not my job. I'm not here to critique those elements. I'm here to say they either do or don't fit into the work I'm trying to create here. Mark goes on to describe how he and many authors use critical thinking in the writing process. Quote, "As I draft these words, I'm constantly reading, reviewing, tweaking, and editing as I go along. Tomorrow, there will certainly be an editing stage where I give the whole article a thorough review and proofread. But it's not simply a case of draft today, edit tomorrow. It's more like a spectrum, with writing at one end and critiquing at the other, or an ongoing dialogue between two voices. The first writing session involves more writing than critiquing, and the final session has more critiquing than writing, but I'm using both skills together right from the start," end quote. So critical thinking gives us constraints or context to help us make something better, more useful, more engaging, etc. It's not a judgment to tear someone down or something down, take it down a peg, or make you feel inferior. When that kind of energy pops up, it's not critical thinking, it's judgment. And that is what you need to release. Drop it like it's hot. Instead, do the thing and evaluate it later. Another one of Sister Carita's rules. Rule 8 says, don't try to create and analyze at the same time. They're different processes. So set your constraints at the beginning of the project. Then take action. That's why we say plan, do, evaluate, and then celebrate. Give yourself a plan. That's the context. Then take action. Only after you take an action do you start the evaluative process. And it's a critical thinking evaluation, not an exercise in passing judgment. Sometimes the results aren't what we want, but that's how we learn. That's how we grow. We can almost always recover, but if we don't try in the first place, we're never going to feel successful. You'll just keep looking around, wishing things could be different than they are. Create an environment of empowerment for yourself. Start by taking a closer look at those definitions you created for yourself from a couple of episodes ago, episode 2 of season 7. Start looking for the gaps between what you've defined as success for yourself and where you are. Realize that you may not be able to close all those gaps right away. That's normal. Be patient and compassionate with yourself about the gaps. And you can recognize things that you can start to do right now to close them. Maybe it's only one thing. Maybe the things you come up with all seem overwhelming. Great. Pick one. Break it down using this week's downloadable guide. Or ask for help to break it down. Don't try to do all this in a vacuum. That's part of your environment of empowerment. Having the right tools and the right people in your orbit to support and encourage and help you. Also, for a little extra credit, dip into the recording of the town hall inside the Rising Tide Learning Library. It's a conversation between me and members of the Creative Freedom community about navigating uncertainty, distinguishing between legitimate fear and the fears created by our fears and shoulds. Fear doesn't go away. It serves a purpose, and you need to get better at distinguishing legit fear from the other stuff. An environment of empowerment helps. It gives you a safe, grounded space. Courage doesn't exist without fear. Remember, we don't need courage without fear. And courage comes in the daily to-dos that you do as you are able. Your environment helps you to be able to do. That includes your supporters, the food you eat, the way you move your body, or not. It means really listening to yourself and learning to trust that part of you again, or for the first time. That's the way to take the invisible cap off your income, off your results, off your success. Drop the judgment and give yourself an environment of empowerment, a safe space to experiment. Take the pressure off the work you're doing and give yourself permission to be curious. Otherwise, you'll continue to stay stuck in the past over paradox indefinitely, watching everyone else and thinking, dang it, that should be me. Next time, we'll take the conversation about safety up a notch and answer the question, do you have to choose between being safe and being successful? How does safety and an environment of empowerment really play into accelerating success? Be sure you subscribe to get notified, hit the bell, kiss your mama, leave a review, whatever else the hot thing to do right now is, so that you'll know about our upcoming episodes. And I sure hope we'll see you there. Until then, for more inspiration and education to help you unleash your star power and own your dreams without selling your soul, come see what's shaking over creativefreedomshow.com. You know you want to.